Well, I'd like to welcome you. Thanks for coming. It's pretty cool in here, not too bad. My goal today is when you leave, I hope you have a new piqued interest in observing birds. And I want to just kind of talk about how bird watching is a lot, that kind of embodies a lot of the principles of Holden. One of the great things about bird watching is it's always better done in community. It's always better to have four pair of eyes or six pairs of eyes rather than just your own. And what I've discovered, I got interested in bird watching in college and then after college, and whenever I moved around, it became this wonderful place for me through the local Audubon chapters to go on some field trips, be with very diverse and interesting people who I would never run into contact in my regular life. Just kind of opens up friendships and relationships with people. And you also get to see everybody's strengths, because somebody is going to see something that you don't see. Even if they don't know anything about birds, maybe the expert over here knows a lot, but this person, we all kind of go out with adding value to the group. So bird watching is so fun. I live in Wenatchee, and earlier this month, two friends who, they do a lot of canoeing. They've never even thought about the birds. They kind of bugged me and said, let's go bird watching. So we met at 6 in the morning in the Little State Park there. They were hooked. You know, it's just, it's kind of a value added for your outdoor outings. I got an email from one of the women, they just gone canoeing, and they said, oh, we've got to go canoeing and go bird watching. And so at any time of life, it's something you can start. The other thing about bird watching is you can continually improve. I've been bird watching 30 years, and I'm kind of an advanced beginner. There's so much more that I want to learn and want to know about. You can go a lot of directions. You don't want to be intimidated by running into those life list birders. Sometimes that can turn beginners off. There are competitive birders out there, and that's not what most birders are, but you have to be careful if you go on an Audubon trip and you have one of these people with you that are, you know, I'm going to see this bird, and then I need to quickly move on. And I think, I don't know, in one of the newspapers I was reading the last year, there was a big article in New Jersey. There's a big competitive birding activity. Does anybody know about that? So anyway, so be aware of that, and don't let that kind of scare you off. But most people, that's not on their agenda. But a lot of people do keep what's called a life list. And I don't keep one specifically, but I kind of have it in my head. And I'm pretty excited on the Monkey Bear Falls Trail. I saw a bird that I identified myself for the first time, this warbling vireo. So it's the kind of thing, you have personal growth that you can keep track of in any way that you want. And tonight, we're going to actually walk. It's scheduled 6:15 to 7:15, so I think we'll meet on the ARC. So if you want to come, I was going to do more of the nuts and bolts, things about binoculars and bird books and clothing and activity. I'm going to hold off that information till tonight. So what we'll do is meet on the ARC. We will walk the gravel road to the little bridge, and that's a place I think we're going to see swallows, evening grosbeaks, robins, finches. In the mornings, they've been there a lot. So I want to take us to a place where we can see birds pretty close. So if you have binoculars or you can borrow some, be good, but I think we'll be close enough that you could come without binoculars. And then people could turn around at that point, or people who want to climb a little bit, I thought we'd go up to where the Mine Museum is and just go on the road a little bit toward Honeymoon Heights. That's a neat place because you get at treetop level as you look down slope, so you can see the layers of the conifer trees. So a place you could go on your own anytime when you're in the village is to walk up to the Chalet Circle. And a lot of you, when you're staying in the lodges, you haven't maybe gone up there. There's a circle of grass, so you could sit out up there. And there are nesting boxes on almost all the chalets. So right now there are violet green swallows, adults feeding young in a nest box. There's an American robin feeding young. Two of the porches have hummingbird feeders on them. So I'm going to hopefully introduce you to some things to start looking for. So, you know, in the village tonight, if you want a place that's cool, go sit on the grass up there, or in the morning. The best time to see birds is in the cool of the day. And this is a really heat-stressing kind of week for birds. They can overheat. So there's not a lot of activity right now. About 10 o'clock, things really quiet down. So if you're an early riser and you want to walk the Monkey Bear Falls Trail or the Ten Mile Falls Trail, or you want to walk over toward Honeymoon Heights, even as early, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, you're going to see a lot of bird activity that if we were out now, you wouldn't get to see. Now, the reason Holden is so active with birds right now that we can see is that both males and female adults are feeding young in the nest. So they're collecting food for extra bodies. So they have to be out doing a lot of food collecting. So that makes good bird watching time of year. So I thought I'd start off with just a little bit of background about birds that maybe set them apart from mammals and other other things. And I want to point out just some key kind of anatomy stuff that then later on I think you'll see how that applies. and I'm going to sit down just so I can read my notes with my reading glasses. I just want you to think for a second, what makes a bird a bird? You know, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Just maybe call it out. What makes
wings.
A bird?
Wings.
Wings? Feathers? Anything else? Beaks, okay. Those are all key characteristics. We do have bats that have wings. We do have some flying fish, right, that can leap out of the water and fly. But feathers. And then the beaks, which is that adaptation for feeding, those are kind of the two characteristics. But feathers is really the thing that sets birds apart from all other animals with backbones. So if you take a look at the feathers, there are two basic types of feathers. You've all probably picked up feathers. This long type called the contour feather or the flight feather. And then this one that has the downy is the more insulating job of a bird. All birds have downy feathers. Some of these contour feathers will have a downy feather at the bottom. And you know, the young birds have first downy feathers before they grow in their contour feathers. But feathers kind of do five major things. Feathers are what allow birds to fly in such a streamlined manner. The feathers are shaped to be very smooth, have very little resistance. Creating lift is so important for flight, and so the feathers, by having that smooth surface, especially these feathers that are exposed on the outside of the bird, that's a flight adaptation to help them get off the ground. They're very streamlined. And as we have lots of birds flying around the village, kind of do some looking at how they're able to quickly get off the ground and be into flight. And you think about when you get on an airplane and we have to do that long acceleration on the airport ramp. Think about how quickly the birds get lift, and that really has to do with their incredible streamlined design for flight. The other thing they do is protect the skin very effectively. So it's an armor that covers the whole body, just like we have fingernails that protect our skin. They basically have a fingernail kind of adaptation for their whole body. And the downy feathers, as I mentioned before, are really important for insulation. You've probably all seen the penguin movie. What was it? March of the Penguins? You know, those darn penguins have an incredible insulated ability to be warm despite being in Antarctica. So that, and we all buy down coats. You know, we use the downy feathers of birds to insulate us. So that's a key role for feathers. And then feathers have another role of being colorful. And so that's the entire job of a male being colorful to attract a female. And yet some birds are very camouflaged. So another color adaptation is to help the bird hide in their surroundings. Feathers do grow, just like fingernails. And this is the time of year when you see maybe a crow or raven overhead. They'll look kind of scraggly, a raggle muffin. They'll have some missing feathers. Birds like hawks and ravens will lose one flight feather at a time and then grow in a new one every year. So all their feathers are replaced annually. Birds like ducks and geese, when they fly north to their nesting grounds, they lose all their flight feathers at once. So they're incredibly vulnerable for a 5 or 6 week period where they're growing in those new flight feathers. And I once had a very fun job up in central Alaska in the Innoko Wildlife Refuge. We were there during flightless white-fronted geese season, and we would drive these motorboats on the Innoko River. We'd bank them, and we'd jump out of the boats, and we had nets, and we would chase geese that couldn't fly in the tall grass, and then we would capture them, and then we would put them in our laps, and we would sex them and band them. And as an aside, having all that bird poop over me is what made me say to my husband, okay, I think I can do baby. So funny family story. So my son, who's now 22, he's a direct result of my bird banding in a notebook. The other thing birds have are oil glands, and you've often seen birds doing preening. So the function of the oil is to help smooth off the surface. Birds are really plagued by mites and ticks, all kinds of those kind of things. So the oil is helping keep an insulating layer, waterproofing, and also cleaning. So birds have those oil glands. And some, as you can kind of see, some birds would really have way more oil glands than others. The ocean seabirds, like the puffins. The black-capped chickadee doesn't have as much need to be waterproof as a puffin does. So you mentioned flight, and again, for 90% of birds, flight is really a defining characteristic. Flight is such an amazing adaptation. It allows birds to quickly escape predators. It allows them to search very large areas for food, both seasonally, daily, and it allows them to travel very long distances to escape inclement weather, lack of food. So flight is really the adaptation that has made birds so successful as a group of organisms. And if you look at some of the different kinds of flight feathers, and this is something that you can see right here in Holden today, birds have different kinds of flight needs. And some birds like the swift, which is more like our, we've got a lot of swallows in the village right now. So, you know, that should kind of, that, when you've been looking up in the sky, this should look familiar. And if you've ever been out on the ocean and seen some of the big ocean seabirds, these incredibly long wings. Both of these are designed to be fast flyers and designed to be soaring flyers. So kind of a contrast, but the shape of the wing is allowing them to collect food in the place where that kind of flight is needed. And then the hummingbirds, which are up on some of the chalet porches now, and if you wear red around the village, you might get buzzed right now. The hummingbirds have this amazing, more helicopter style that allows them to go up and down, sideways and back. And it is phenomenal. The smallest hummingbird in the world is the calliope, and it's one of the hummingbirds that are up here in the North Cascades. They weigh less than a dime, and they migrate across the Gulf of Mexico. So, you know, you just think, wow, that just incredible. And you think about the energy required to power the muscles to do that kind of fast flight. Just one of those amazing things. And then a lot of you have seen, say a pheasant that's used to, you know, not very good at long distance flight, not good at hovering. You never see a pheasant up there hovering above a field. But they're able to maneuver and change direction, quickly get up and move. And many of our hawks, we have several hawks, the shark, they have the striped tail, I'm blanking out right now, the sharp shin hawk, and the Cooper's hawk, which are often in our neighborhoods. You know, they're maneuvering power lines and trees, and they're zipping down and capturing that house sparrow at your feeder. So those short, broad wings allow maneuverability versus, say, more an eagle, which is more like this, the broad plank-like wings that allows for incredible high soaring. You would never see an eagle, you know, maneuvering in your backyard and flying back up. Now, one of the problems with having to fly... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I want to ask a stupid question because it was asked of me and I didn't know really the answer, the definitive answer. Somebody tried to tell me that hummingbirds will hitchhike on the back of a moose.
Wow. You know, I've not read that, but I want to look that up. You know, that's for Wikipedia, right? We have this new tool in Google that we can now look that up. You know, 10 years ago, I'll look that up tonight. Or I guess not today, when I get home. I want to talk about this problem of needing to fly, you need to be lightweight. So one, somebody mentioned beaks earlier as a key adaptation for being a bird. When you have a beak, it means you don't have teeth. So if you think about how heavy our teeth are and how that would really weigh you down in flight, so birds all have beaks, but that means that they have no way of chopping up their food into small pieces. So birds have this pretty exciting digestive system. Now, my husband's a gastroenterologist, so in my family, we're always into this pooping and eating. It's kind of a fun thing. So it's what my children talk about at the dinner table, you know. So birds are able to, they're down on the ground, they're in a pit, they can quickly swallow kind of a large amount of food, quickly swallow that and store it into this sac called the crop. Then they can escape. You know, they can get up out of there. They can go to their nest. They can get high-density, calorie-packed, heavy food and get it here into the crop. Then, as it goes down, there is a grinding muscular sac. You've probably seen chicken gizzards. It's pretty fun to dissect those open if you get some. It's a fun thing to do. So this is a sac, and some birds, like chickens, actually swallow small grinding stones. So it's the mortar and pestle concept. So by having a few rocks in there, they're able to grind up their food. But all birds do have a gizzard. So this is that grinding mechanism that functions like teeth. And it's they can delay it. They don't have to chew on sight. And it's a way of grinding the food so then the regular digestive enzymes and the process of digestion can happen. So that's a really uniquely lightweight adaptation. Now, the other adaptation birds have are, we loosely use the word hollow bones. Now, they're not really hollow. They have struts inside of them. So next time you have a chicken wing or a breast, you know, the breast with the chicken wing attached, see if you can open up that bone, and it's not 100% bone all the way through. If you take like a beef bone, you know, it's quite a bit of bone, and then there's the marrow inside. But if you compare that to a goose or a duck or a chicken bone, there's a lot of struts and air space. So they, in order to support flight, they need rigidity. They need to have that good structure to support the wings and also to protect all the organs. But by being slightly hollow, it again, it's a lightweight adaptation. And sometimes for kids, I make a model of two toilet paper tubes. One you fill with plaster of Paris, and the other you take just an index card and fold it into a triangle and stick it inside. So when you add up that for their small size, you add up that weight reduction, it really is a big help. Now I thought, again, this is getting you ready to, you know, be this very good observer in the field, because one of the first things you want to look at thinking about this whole bird biology is the structure of the beak. So when you walk out, if you can just make yourself look first at the beak, you know, we all want to look at color first. But that's kind of one of the hazier, less helpful characteristics for birds. But kind of train your eye to take a look at that bill. Now, right now we've got the swallows flying, and they are capturing insects on the wing. So their mouths are open, so they're soaring, and they're just feeding off insects and all the moths and everything on flight. So this would be that kind of adaptation. A snipe, and there actually is a snipe. I'm in a bird watching group, and we go to Lake Wenatchee and hear snipes, so it's not a joke. But they're in wetlands, and they're probing down in the mud for getting small insects. So they have this long probing beak. Toucans, the biggest example of one adapted for eating large fruits. And then a pelican, if you've ever seen, with this large sack, adapted for scooping a fish out of the water, carrying it back to a place where they can swallow it whole, get into the gizzard, and start digesting it. And we do have the hummingbirds here that have the long nectar-sipping beaks. And then we have a lot of grosbeaks right here around the village now with these very heavy bill. These are designed for prying open pine cones and eating seeds. So in a coniferous forest, you'd expect that one of the big foods here are the seed crops of the cone. So that's the grosbeaks. And then if you've ever seen any of a hawk or an eagle or an owl close up, you know they have this amazing lethal bill. This group of birds are a little unique because the definition of a raptor or a bird of prey is that they first kill with their feet and then they use their bill to rip it into shreds to swallow it whole. So that's a knife-like adaptation. And then a lot of the little songbirds that you're going to see in the village have this little thin little bill that can probe into bark cracks or on leaves. These are insects. They're eating little larvae and moths and insects. And this is a good time of year to see them actually gathering those because they're taking back to the nest. So kind of a corollary to the beaks, I'd already mentioned the raptor feet, but the other thing after you look at the beak, try and look at the feet, because that's going to give you clues for the kind of food it eats, which can help you figure out what kind of bird it is. So you all know ducks, the webbed foot. We won't see any webbed feet creatures up here. Or the long-legged herons, the wading birds. So wetlands and marshes are places to look for that adaptation. But we do have woodpeckers and sapsuckers in the village, and they all have this climbing adaptation. They have the ability to walk up a tree, and then they use their tail as a fulcrum. So it may be dark. You may not be able to tell anything about the bird, but you hear somebody walking up bark. So often for me, if I hear noise going up a bark, my brain already starts to think, oh, woodpecker, sapsucker. So one of the fun things about bird watching is kind of this game with yourself. You're out there, you get some little clue, and then you take what you know to kind of make some visualizations of what it could be. And I'm always way too optimistic. You know, I always want to see the rare, exciting bird, and that doesn't always happen.
How about the birds that go down?
Yes, and so the brown creeper, and so that's a great thing. We're going to talk about behavior too. So there's a creeper that goes down, am I reversing that?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, so we've got the nuthatches that go down and the creepers that go up. So the creepers go up and then they'll loop back down and they'll go up again. So the direction of the tree climbing is an important clue. I kind of have dyslexia and I always mix up that kind of stuff. Yeah, which one was that? Now, we haven't talked about vision yet. Most birds, and you'll see birds doing their head a lot. Most songbirds, all the birds except the raptors, have birds on the side of their head. which in a way, you know, they don't have binocular vision, so they're not as able to maybe get to use their eyes to focus to actually get a moving target. The raptors have eyes in the front of their head, so they can focus on a rabbit, a moving animal, and they can then carefully do, you know, spy the animal from way up high, come down, and then be accurate. But other birds, the songbirds, have birds on the side of their head, so they're able to see predators and danger all around. And they also have fairly good hearing, so sometimes you'll hear birds cocking their head. They have a good sense of hearing, a good sense of vision, and they have a very poor sense of smell, so that's not one of their adaptations. Okay, well, we're going to move to slides. I've kind of gone through and picked out common birds of the village. We're going to look at pictures. But I wanted to kind of put together some of the things to look for. Bird books have a vocabulary, and I think you don't have to worry too much about the vocabulary, but when you're out and you see a bird, if you can jot down any notes about it, if it's really an unknown and you want to figure it out. We've already talked about looking at the beak and looking at the feet. The other thing, and this is a little acronym that helps some people, so you want to look for size and shape. So that's the overall size of the bird, the overall shape. And that would include the leg shape, you know, those long wading legs. Just what in general things about the shape are going to help you categorize that bird. And then color. And color's problematic because if it's poor lighting, you can't see color. So we're going to de-emphasize color because we all get discouraged because color's so easy to do and that's not the best. But action is really helpful. And tonight we're going to kind of go look at some different habitats. And in my slides, I tried to put some things about what kind of behavior and action is the bird doing. And then the other really fun one is noise. What is their call? Anybody here really good on calls? That is a whole separate area that is so fun. And there are a lot of tools available now. Birds have a song sung by the male in mating season or breeding season. Then they have calls, just a short note that's often just a way to locate each other. And both of those can be learned by species. And there's many, now with the internet, you can go to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. You come back from being out in the field, you pull up the Cornell Lab of Ornithology site, you punch in the bird, up comes a photograph, a range map distribution, and then a little button where you press sound. Now there are many other sources of that. Many people have MP3 players, and my husband's job partner showed me his new iPhone, and he has this adaptation for birds of Western North America. So we were in a noisy room, and I wasn't that impressed because you'd need earphones to really hear it well. But I thought, well, that's pretty cool. You know, up here in Holden, you can bring your MP3 player and go back and listen. And the other thing I have chosen to do are CDs, and I like habitat collections. So I keep in my car. Portland Audubon years ago had a wonderful cassette tape, and I haven't checked to see if they've made it to a CD. Does anybody know? Birds of the Pacific Northwest. It is so good because they'll say, birds of suburban neighborhoods. And so you'll hear 8 birds of wetlands, birds of the conifer forest, and from the region. And for me, I don't want to hear 5 different warblers. I want to hear just maybe the 2 that might be here because I'm still having a hard time learning warblers. But it is a whole very fun thing. Some people like to come up with acronyms to describe the sound. The chickadee-dee-dee is one that most people know. Now, chickadees make several other sounds, so you have to be careful not just to rely on thinking it's that one call. They also make a very plaintive 2-note, dee-dee, in kind of a minor key. So all those nuances are really fun. And I have Brittany Spaniel dogs at home, and they kind of go crazy when I put the CD on it. So it's kind of fun to play tricks on your dogs to have them get active. Yeah. It's the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And they have been leaders in the field for initiating citizen science projects. So one thing I wanted to mention, another way to become involved with birding is to participate with one of their projects. They have does anybody do them in here? They have a backyard bird count. And you know, you probably heard of the Christmas bird count through National Audubon Society. So most local Audubon chapters have a Christmas bird count over a 2-week period. For example, that in Wenatchee, we have, I think, 5 different days for different regions. People get together, they do a set route, and they record all the birds that they've seen. And it's called citizen science because it's not as rigorously collected with controls that, say, an experiment would be, but it's huge amounts of data. So by putting it all together, they're starting to be able to look at, is climate change causing birds to come sooner? And this is actually, birds are coming 2 weeks sooner. The insects aren't ready to eat yet. So, you know, there are a lot of values for having citizen scientists all over the country input data. A while ago, they did a tanager. They asked people to set up a tanager circle. There are three tanagers in the in North America or in the United States. And I investigated doing that, and at the time I didn't do it. But it's a fun way, if you're kind of a project person and you want to get into birding, that's a nice avenue. And then the Audubon Christmas counts happen every year, everywhere. So if you're traveling, you probably could find a Christmas bird count to take part in. And usually, you know, it's cold, and then you get together for potluck afterwards and share your list. It's got a nice kind of community component. So again, vocabulary, I wanted to just show. Tonight we'll talk more about bird books, but most bird books have a very nice introduction to birding in the beginning. And the two that are being most used in the Pacific Northwest right now, this National Geographic, it is, I think, the third or fourth edition. So this says fifth edition. I finally bought the fifth edition. So if you're going to buy a bird book, maybe avoid buying a used one just so you can get the most current edition that has updates in it. And then Sibley's has really come on board as the... maybe if you're going to buy one book, this might be the best one to buy. These books are prepared by having artists take on groups. They collect museum samples from all over the country, so they're composite drawings. So the artist that does the Western Tanager might have in front of him 10 stuffed tanagers. And so composite is better, and that's why photographs are the least desirable thing to use to identify birds, because light and color is so variable. Now, there are some really good photo bird books, so it's kind of your learning style and what works for you. There's a new one out for birds of, I have it, it might be Birds of Washington, I think, that's a photograph. So, you know, if you're going to just buy one book, a book that's based on composite drawings is probably best, but it's nice to have quite a few books, so when you come home, you can open them up and spread them out. Yeah.
I was going to say, a lot of times I use one that does have photographs because they're in by color.
Yes.
And then
okay.
I can look in there and I can see a whole variety of birds in that color. Then I get the Sibley's to find out what they're doing.
Great. Yeah. And it's nice, we have so many tools now, you know, that you really need to have a bird book with you in the field. Because, you know, you can, it's so nice to be able to look it up, and the bird's stationary, you can really have time to, you know, you're trying to figure out what it is, you can actually often do that. So a bird that fits in your pocket, this one's a little big, so that's even a consideration. You know, you want to, you know, it's hard to clutch a book and your binoculars and a notebook. So it's, and then the other thing that's so nice for birding is to use a scope. And one reason to go with a group of people, like an Audubon group, is someone usually brings their scope. And the neat thing about scopes, they're very expensive. People love to share. It's so fun when you are the scope owner to get the bird in perfect focus and then to say, do you want to look? It's really great. And so for learning a bird the first time, getting to see it in magnification helps so much. Once you've seen it close and really learned it, then you're able to figure out what are those key field marks. What's that thing, that flash of white on the tail? We have a lot of dark-eyed juncos here, and as you're walking the trails, you'll hear a little rustle of the leaves, and you might just see a little bit of white as the tails, the scissor tails, are flashing open. So that's the fun part of birding, you know, it's continually building on your knowledge. And like I said, I feel like I'm an advanced beginner. I was really, before I had children, I was doing it intensely, and then I've had this 20-year break, and now I'm back into it. But it's a very fun thing. So let's look at some slides. I have to apologize for archaic technology. I was going to transfer all this to PowerPoint, but last week I had the chance to go birding on Monday, botanizing all day Thursday, and, oh, I did something else with the land trust on another day. So I thought, okay, field biology versus technology. For me, going outside won. Can't even know how to turn this thing off. But it is kind of funny. Our technician setting up has never seen a slide projector. Where's the off button for this?
Unplug it.
Unplug it. That's a good idea. Okay. I always like to start with the robin. You know, wherever I go in the United States, I've been on the coast of Maine, I've been on the California coast, the Washington coast, the Rockies, everywhere. Okay, you see? Want to turn the lights off? American robins are absolutely everywhere, and they're here in Holden in abundance. And one of your first tendencies is to say, oh, an American robin, I know that bird. But the way to kind of approach it is to really get to know the American robin so you can use it as a comparison point. So I'm not very good at memorizing numbers, but 10 inches is the number to remember for American robin. From the tip of the beak to the tip of the tail is 10 inches. So if you can have that memorized as a search image, right away when you see a new bird, the question to say is it bigger than a robin or smaller than a robin? And that's a really helpful characteristic. In all the bird books, the first number after the name, they give the length, which is from the tip of the beak to the tip of the tail, and then they give the wingspan. And that's a really good key because size is often hard to tell out in a big landscape. But if you can, you know, get that search image of a robin in your head, it's going to help you even if you're against a giant mountain or a rocky slope. But size is hard to tell. For example, it's hard to tell a raven from a crow just by size because the landscape is so big. So you've got to look at the tail. Robins have... I wanted to focus on the eye. Notice the white around the eye. A lot of birds have either feathers that are white around the eye or actually bare skin. So if you can take a look at that eye and see if it has an eye ring, that's going to really help you in identifying a lot of birds. And then again, look at that bill. It's kind of a multi-purpose bill. They're not just gleaning in bark cracks like the warblers. This is a bird that eats a wide variety of food. So it's like one of those combination forks and spoons. Uh-huh. This is sort of a combination, not super identified well for anything, but they can eat seaweed on the coast, they can be up here at Holden, they can just really switch their diets a lot. Most birds eat a plant diet much of the year, but during breeding or incubation season and nesting and feeding of young, they switch to an insect diet. So that's kind of a, that's not true for all birds, but that is kind of a tendency. And you kind of think about that. They've got to get concentration of protein and fats for growing babies, and it, different than the rest of the year.
Why are robins so much more successful than the other thrushes?
I wonder that. And, you think about weeds, the corollary in our world are weeds. We have a lot of invasive weeds. Why are they so successful? I think it's because they can adapt to so many different food sources, and they've adapted well to humans. I wonder, 300 years ago, before we had intensive human development, were robins as common here? Or have they just adapted to human settlement so well? Because wherever we go, it's human settlement, and we see robins. But that's a question I share. So again, you see this bird. You want to look at the breast, and here we have a colored breast. You want to look at the color underneath the bill. It's tempting just to look at the whole bird, but often if you can focus on that head first, the eye ring, the coloring, you want to look for stripes on the top of the head, maybe stripes through the eye, stripes above the eye, or stripes below the eye. And that's where having a notebook and something to jot it down is helpful out in the field. So now we're going to start small. So this is our 10-inch standard. So I've picked birds that are common around the village, and I'm going to go small, and we're going to work our way up. So most of you probably know the black-capped chickadee. Again, it's a very successful bird across the northern part of North America. And it is 5 inches, so it's half a robin. So, okay, the next thing to do is, okay, what two chickadees equal one robin? If you can start kind of getting that size idea in your head, again, this is going to help you figure out birds that are maybe even tinier, hummingbird, or even a little bit bigger but not robin size. And up here at Holden, there's several chickadees. So again, this might be a bird you know well, but we have the mountain chickadee, which has, it looks like a bandit. It looks like it's got a white and white here, and then it's got a black scarf on its eyes. So that's the mountain chickadee. And then we have a chestnut. Is it chestnut-sided or chestnut-backed? Chestnut-backed. And I was up at Honeymoon Heights, and all I caught, I could tell it was a chickadee by where it was, and I heard its sound, and then I caught a flash of the rufousy red color. So I thought, okay, so there are three chickadees that can be here. You don't just assume it's the black-capped, but you know this one as your search image. It's a little bark gleaner. So take a look at that bill. Notice it's pretty probing. It's able to reach in a crack, get a small insect. And it also eats conifer seeds, so that's why they can be here year-round when insects are less active. They're already eating seeds out of cones. And during breeding season, they really do switch to kind of an invertebrate or an animal diet. Now, going up a little in size and also in a different part of the tree, these first three I'm showing you could all be in the same spot on Earth. So we'd have the chickadee up in kind of the mid-level of the conifer. Well, maybe at the base of this tree, you're going to see the dark-eyed junco. And again, it's fairly small. Notice no white eye ring, kind of a red eye. Now, the red's not always going to show. But look at that black hood all the way down. And it's important to notice that the hood is in the front as well as the back. So it's a complete hood. And it's 6 inches. So it's slightly bigger than the chickadee, but, you know, 5 inches to six, that's a hard thing to tell in the field. But notice the bill difference. So if all you capture is just a glimpse of a bird maybe you just get the bill, this is very thick. They're going to be feeding way more on the ground, and they're going to be feeding on seeds. They need that cracking ability, that lever arm of a thick, thickened bill. And this could be, and today I went onto Tamale Falls, and there was a chickadee, you know, rustling in the leaves. I kind of spooked him out of the ground. Now, you can't see it on this picture, but they have white on the outer edge of their tail. So when they fly, it's like the scissors opening and closing, and they have white. And that's what we call a field mark. That's, you don't see the whole bird, you just get this flash. And if you know the size and you're in the right habitat, you can pretty assuredly say, okay, that's a dark-eyed junco. Now, there's a lot of swallows in the village now. This is kind of these aren't my photos, you know, I have them from a book. But I'm using them for education, so it's okay. But this is a barn swallow. We have a couple swallows here at Holden that they all kind of look alike in flight until you start keying in on a couple features. This is the one that has the forked tail. So notice that deep forking in the tail. And they do open and close their tail in flight, but if you watch for about a minute, you'll have a chance to see if it's a barn swallow or not, because the barn swallows will open, and you see this lovely U-shaped part of their tail. The color is, especially here at Holden, because you're looking up against a bright sky, color is often really hard to see unless you get the right angle. Evening and morning is better, but you know, I've been looking at the swallows here, and you can't just always immediately say what it is, because you can't see some of the color. But they have the orange that does show if the light is right on their breast, and that blue shiny kind of on the back. So they're really fun to watch there. I think I saw, down here in the village, I think I saw a nest. Has anybody seen a nest for the barn swallow? But I'm pretty sure they're usually here. I've only seen the violet green swallows up a little higher. So this is a 7-inch bird. So we're going up in size. Yeah?
Question, how do you tell the difference between a martin and a swallow?
Well, martins, the field mark is they have more cigar-shaped body when they fly. And they do have a little bit different flight pattern. We have the Vox's swifts and then the purple martins. So we have more swifts here. And I'm kind of still learning those, but you can tell by the cigar-shaped body. So as you're out here looking at swallows, look up and kind of note what a non-cigar-shaped body is. And that will help you then when you see a swift or a martin to know it's slightly different. But they feed in the same manner. And again, these are feeding in the air. Their mouths are open. They're swooping. They're gathering all their food that way. So here's another species that's here. This is not a great photo. This is my example of why you need a composite drawing, not just a one-time color photo. But I use this one because it shows, look at the head. This is a tree swallow. And they have that same kind of dark green glossy back that might look like a barn swallow. It's kind of the same black color. But notice the white that extends from underneath the bill all the way down. But notice there's no white on the lower part of the back that you can see. So those are important things to differentiate it from the violet green swallow, which I'll show you now. So this is the violet green swallow. And again, this photo is not as helpful as it needs to be. This is you can often see the white going above the eye. But the more diagnostic thing to see is there's actually white that wraps around and almost meets and touches. You see that in flight. And that's pretty easy to see here at Holden. And that's, so we've got all three of these swallows here. Violet greens are in greatest abundance, barn swallows, and then tree swallows. So if you can learn the violet green, and you have to watch it fly for a while, but you'll see this white that wraps around the rear end. And by being on the slope, if you go up to the chalets, you're kind of, sometimes they're flying a little below you, and you can have more of a straight on view to get to see that. And they're also sitting on the telephone lines resting. So that's a chance, if the sun's right, to see some of the color and to look at the white that goes either above the eye for the violet green or below for the tree swallow. So those are three birds to kind of learn while you're here. Now I'm going to kind of go a little bit up in size. This is an 8-inch bird, which you all probably know, the starling. But it's unique in that during breeding season, the bills turn orange. The speckling is not all the time. But most of you know a starling, and it's smaller than a robin, but it's bigger than these little, than the swallows and the chickadee. And they are here in the village. We also have brown-headed cowbirds here, which are kind of a pest. They're kind of a problem bird. They historically lived with the buffalo. So they followed the moving herds of buffalo. As the buffalo stirred up the dust, they were eating insects. They were in kind of a, you know, not huge abundance. But as we've become a cultivated country, we have all kinds of agriculture, brown-headed cowbirds have exploded all the way across the country. And they are what we call nest predators. So they will lay their egg in the nest of another songbird. Their eggs are a little bigger than their nest mates. They hatch sooner. They hog the food and rely on the songbird parents to feed them. So brown-headed cowbirds are everywhere. They have a really cool call. It sounds like somebody has turned on water that's dribbling down a faucet. And it's a really fun kind of a call. And they're in the village, and I've seen them, heard them calling in some of the trees. In the right light, you do see a brown head. So one reason to kind of learn the starling is because there's some other blackbirds and there's the brown-headed cowbird that all have this dark color, but you're looking for slightly different features. Now we have a lot of woodpeckers up here. This is one you probably know. It's all across the country. Again, it's such a successful bird. This is the American, the common flicker. You might know it as the red-shafted flicker and the yellow-shafted flicker. Well, about 20 years ago, the ornithologists put them all together as one flicker. And they have a white rump. So the key thing when they're flying away, they've got a big white rump that really shows as a flash of white. They tend to be on the ground more than other woodpeckers. They are in trees, but they're also kind of on the ground. And they're very adapted to our urban, suburban habitats. They migrate through, and they are up here at the village. In terms of size, they're now 12 inches, so we're getting bigger than a robin. And again, this is a bird you probably know, so kind of that 12 inches, that 1 foot from the tip of the beak to the tip of the tail is another kind of size mark. Now, the interesting bird that I hope to see when I'm here, I'm pretty sure I heard it calling. Has anybody seen one while they're here? This is a signature species for intact old-growth forest in the Pacific Northwest. This is the pileated woodpecker. It has the woody woodpecker kind of a call, that lovely kind of red on the head, black. And notice how the tail is balanced down. That's a very, that's classic woodpecker form for helping them climb trees. They're using their tail as a fulcrum. This is a bigger bird than the flicker. Let's see, these guys are 16 inches, so they are big. So when you see one of these, you'll know it. They tend to carve rectangular holes that are rectangular shaped within the first 5 feet off the ground. And so if you see kind of a squarish hole, I saw some of them on the Monkey Bear Falls Trail, and I think today I heard one. I'm still learning my woodpecker calls, so if anybody hears one, I think we've got some good ear birders here. It would be one of those birds I like to visualize that I get to see. My husband and I have a little tiny cabin 20 miles that way, and we do have pileated woodpeckers on that ridge, so it's a kind of an exciting thing. Now I do want to shift to color, even though I said color is really hard, but I'm going to illustrate why color is hard with the hummingbirds. Here at Holden Village, we mostly have the rufous hummingbirds. I'm pretty sure I've seen a calliope, but I'm having trouble feeling absolutely confident. Has anybody ID'd a calliope? They're our smallest hummingbird. They have green on the back, and they don't have any rufous on the tail. But I know we have the rufous hummingbirds, and they tend to have a lot of this rufous, which is a reddy brown color that shows on the tails, one of the field marks. But the problem with hummingbirds is that they are actually iridescent. So without light, you can't see any color. It's not a pigment. it's a light conducting feature called iridescence. So hummingbirds are hard to tell if you're only going on color. But if you get good light and you see good color, then it's nice to use that, because that's like, okay, great, we can figure that out in the bird book. Now, this is a bird that color is the field mark. I put these in here because most of you have to drive from either Chelan or Wenatchee up here, and you're pretty much sure to see these birds year-round on that drive. And they always seem to be in groups of three. I see them alone sometimes, but they tend to be kind of social. They hang out together. And this is the black-billed magpie, 19 inches long, so almost 20 inches. These are really big birds. That black and white coloration, they think that one of the reasons, like zebras, all kinds of animals have black and white, is it helps break up the image of an animal for a predator. So it maybe doesn't look like a bird because it's got these two contrasting colors. But they are very kind of raucous, noisy. You know they're there. They build these nests out of sticks that are really messy and sloppy. They're kind of a clown character. And another color feature to look for, where we do need color, is in, especially in some of the sparrows. They're hard. We have a song sparrow here, and this photo again doesn't show what I was going to talk about. They have often, if you get the good view, they have what's called an ink spot right here. So it's a blotch of black. And isn't there a sparrow in the Midwest that has an ink spot too? I'm thinking there, at least in our part of the country, there's only one sparrow that has this blotch. Many sparrows have this striping pattern on their breast, but if you see this little black blob right here, you say, okay, song sparrow. The other thing to look for in sparrows is the striping pattern on the head, this kind of white here is characteristic, and then you look at the eye, and then the sparrow has that seed-eating, you know, short, strong bill. And that's where, when you use a bird book, they all have, it's nice to get a book that has a range map next to every species. And this helps you not feel foolish. I've done this. I'm somewhere else, and I say, oh, there's a bird. Well, you look at the range map, and it's only found in Texas. So you go, okay, it's probably not that bird. But it's incredibly helpful when you're trying to figure out a sparrow. You've got four pages of sparrows. So it's nice to go through for your area and say, okay, none of these on this page are here. It's just a nice elimination factor. Now, this is one of my favorite little birds. These are year-round residents, the golden-crowned kinglet. And I put this in because their behavior is often kind of the cue, and also their song, their sound, that might be what they are. They're in groups. They like to be in groups. And they like to be in mixed groups. In the wintertime, they flock with three or four other species, the nuthatches and the chickadees. So that's kind of for winter protection. Quite a few birds will of different species kind of group together. But the kinglets, if you get to see this lovely yellow patch on the head, that is so great, but that doesn't show. So the key color feature, golden crown kinglet, is not the key field feature. But what maybe is this little sound. It's kind of like this. Very quiet, very high pitched. And you hear several of them usually because they're in a group. And also they're up in the top of a conifer tree. That's where you always see them. So if you walk up Honeymoon Heights, there's a pretty good chance you'll hear the golden crown kinglet.
What was the size on that one?
Very tiny, 4 inches. So they're super small, smaller than a chickadee. And then I put this in kind of to show action, flight pattern. We have a lot of turkey vultures. They are migratory. They show up in April. They're up here roosting in conifer trees in the forest. I've not seen any this week, but as you go down lake, you're sure to probably see one. They have what we call as a dihedral shape. So they're soaring, and they tend to do this back and forth V-like pattern. And they also have this transparency, which, you know, 80% of the time really shows this transparency in the wings. They do have no feathers on the head, but they're usually so high up that that's not a field mark, you can tell. They eat carrion and roadkill. So you often see them, you know, along highways because they're eating the roadkill. And they're pretty spectacular birds. Now, another bird you might see on the drive back along the Columbia River, these guys like to perch on the telephone lines above the Columbia, is the kingfisher, belted kingfisher. And I think they're quite comical. They have that oversized head. And if you look at the bill, this is a pretty powerful, strong, and there's serrations in here. These birds are staring down at the Columbia River, looking for a fish. They dive kind of go underwater like an osprey, get that fish, and come back to their perch before they swallow it. So they are they're pretty cool, huge rectangular heads, and then this really oversized bill. But again, that's kind of a behavior. You look on telephone lines above a river, you can narrow down what you might see, and you kind of be looking for that belted kingfisher. And then I put this picture. This is a crow. Now, it's almost impossible in the photo without any context to tell if it's a crow or a raven. In general, ravens have heavier bills. But, you know, if you're out there in a snowy patch, it's hard to tell. So when they fly, you want to look to see. The ravens have what we call a wedge-shaped tail. So it goes across straight for a while, and then it wedges up. But the tail has to be spread out. So you have to kind of watch, and then the call is really helpful too. The raven has a hoarser caw that's just not quite as, it sounds more raucous. And I did hear a raven calling when I was out walking around. So we should have both crows and ravens here. So if you see one, and crows are so common in cities now, they're one of our big urban bird problems, but get to know the crow. So when you come to the mountains and see a raven, you can use those field cues to identify it. Now, this is an introduced bird to the state of Washington. Came in the 1920s as an introduced game bird, and it's been very successful. And you'll see these at Fields Point or in the town of Chelan where you get on the boat. They are in our neighborhoods. They are quite the social birds. They have a call that goes, Chicago, Chicago, Chicago. So it's a very fun call. I heard it when I was getting on the boat at Fields Point. They have these running legs. They have incredibly strong legs. So you'll often see them running across the road as you're driving around in towns, and then eight little babies running behind. And they just have this urgency of running. So
this is what?
This is called the California quail. Introduced. See, where was it introduced from? I'm not sure. We have chucker from Asia. We have pheasant. And we have quail as our big introduced birds. And they've pretty much not caused any problem in Washington. They were introduced for game birds, and they haven't caused problems like, say, a brown-headed cowbird.
Is that different from a grouse?
It's in the same group. It's a grouse-like bird. We do have grouse up here. Has anybody seen a grouse on the trail? Grouse, I ran into one. They use camouflage. This bird was in the middle of the trail. I think it had babies off trail, so it didn't want me to go up there, but it just stood there in the middle of the Monkey Bear Falls trail. And I got within 3 feet, and finally, you know, it stepped aside. But same kind of body shape. Now, I put in the cedar waxwings. Has anybody seen them around the village?
Yes.
Yeah, so they're here. They tend to move through our part of Washington in flocks. And they have another very distinctive, very soft call. And you hear multiples because they're kind of always in groups. So I've seen them three or four places around the village. And they have that wonderful, just that softness. You can really see that streamlineness in how the feathers lay so flat. And then you look at the tail, the stripes on the tail. Oftentimes, there's maybe one bohemian waxwing mixed in with a flock of cedar waxwings out here. So one, you kind of scan because the bohemians have a different pattern of color on their tail, and they're a slightly different size. So look at a flock of cedar waxwings and just go through and make sure they're all the same size and they have the same tail stripe. It's always exciting to see this other less common bird. Now this is a winter wren. I didn't have a picture of a house wren. They are the most vocal, noisy, warbling. Has anybody heard one here? I heard one on the trail. If you hear a bird that just won't stop warbling, it's probably going to be one of these house wrens. They are just, they have so much sound that comes out of their small body. But we do have, the house wren is the common wren here. On the west side of the mountains, there's other wrens. But here, you might expect to see the house wren. And then I did put eagles in because we have had in the last 20 years, a great expansion of population, both resident and winter residents of bald eagles. So along the shores of Lake Chelan, be looking. They're perched in the trees. Most of them, many of them move up to Lake Wenatchee. They move up to Lake Chelan, but then they winter down along the Columbia. So we have a doubling of numbers in the winter, but we do have bald eagles that if you drive through Wenatchee and you keep your eyes open on the way to the Big Y, which is to get to over Blewett Pass, pretty much guaranteed to see at least one eagle and at least one osprey year-round now along the rivers. And they're pretty exciting to have those just be a bird that you expect to see. And the other, I put this in as kind of another kind of way of, okay, you're in a marsh, you're in a cattail marsh, you kind of go there expecting to see some birds. And one of the most common ones you might see would be the red-winged blackbird. So they're not up here at Holden, but you're driving along in the car and you see a little pond on the way to Wenatchee. Look, you're probably going to see a red-winged blackbird. And that's what makes it fun to bird at 60 miles an hour in a car. You know, you're, but not driving. You have to let the driver not be the bird. So I'm almost done. I put this in because this is an exciting time to be at Holden. Western tanagers are in abundance. And we saw some on our 10-mile fall hike the other day. Just amazing. And I've been hearing them call. This is where you need to learn your calls. You learn the robin call. Then you learn the drunken robin, which is a grosbeak, black-headed grosbeak. And then you learn kind of the hoarse, shortened robin, which is the tanager. So again, if for learning these calls, again, if you can have a base that you can compare to, it helps. So we're hearing robins here. So if you hear something in the woods, it's robin-ish. Now, we also have a lot of thrushes here. So a lot of robin-related birds are here at Holden. But it's your chance to hear a western tanager and to get to see them. And I put this in just to say, if you ever come to Holden starting in mid-August and you have an extra day, we have an exciting, we are a hawk migration corridor. This whole Lake Chelan area is funneling migrating hawks from Canada all the way down, and Hawkwatch International runs a staffed station on, as you're going down lake, it's called the Sawtooth Ridge, the mountains on the left side. Well, there's a gravel road, it's an hour drive from Chelan to drive up to this spot, perched on top of the ridge, and they are seeing, starting in mid-August, 120, 130 migrating hawks. And they actually have live birds up there. They have live prey. So they have stellars, or, you know, starlings that somebody brings up. And then they're getting birds to come down, and they're capturing them in a mist net, and then they're abandoning them. And you can often, if they've caught one, you get to see one. So it is really exciting. It's on the Hawkwatch International site, and it'd take kind of a full day if you're going to expand your trip. But a hot, sunny day is the best day because they're using the thermals to rise, and it's staffed all the way through October. But it's and it includes our hawks, golden eagles. Hawks and eagles, but it's mostly the most common bird in the migrating corridor are the red-tailed hawks, Swainsons, Coopers, but they have peregrines and merlins also. So I think we're done. I put this this in because this is the bird that maybe we'll see tonight. There's lots of them in flocks around the village, the evening grosbeak. Notice that big, thick bill, seed-cracking bill, and hopefully tonight when we walk down, we'll see at least 100 of them. And then I put that in just as this was the Hawkwatch migration to make sure I didn't forget to talk about. And then the little pine siskins, they're a bird that you're probably going to see often. They'll be in the road catching its seeds. They have a little tiny bit of yellow there. You might think finch, but we have Cassin's finches up here right now, but we also have the pine siskins. So if you see kind of a boring little bird with some stripes, look to see if you get a hint of yellow, and that's going to be the pine siskin, usually in groups there. They're kind of a groupy bird. Them gray call. And then again, we do have the Cassin's finches. The females are not red, but they're in the village. So if you know a house finch from home, and I'm still working on this because all I have are house finches and I think they're boring, so I don't look at them. But I need to look at them so I can identify the Cassin's for sure and the purple finch. So I need to take my own medicine and go home and really learn my female house finches so I can get up here and do the female Cassin's with 100% assurity. Well, thank you for coming. I know it's time to have lunch, and if you can come tonight, thanks.